We are holding on Paytest Omobase 6 lines from the bottom. We started learning yesterday about the issue of Gidan Moshe, and the Mishnah have said that it applies B'mukdoshin, it does apply to animals of Kodshim as well, unlike, for example, Tisi Adam that we learned about previously, which does not. And we also said that we had a machlokas in the Mishnah whether it applies to a shlil, to a baby found alive in the mother's womb when the mother was shechted. The Tanakhama had said yes, but Yehuda had said no. So now we were trying to figure out what is the chiddush of telling us that it applies to kodesh? Are we going to say that it means that even though it's already also that even though it's already also as gidan moshe, it also becomes also as kodesh as well? The ruling of the Mishnah doesn't suggest that. It suggests the other way around, that first comes the Isser of Kodshin, and then comes the Isser of Gidan Asher. So what's the Chiddush on that? So then we said, are we talking about a baby of Kodshin, where the Tanakhama holds that it applies to a Shlil? And then, so we said, fine, the Mishnah can be saying, first it can be saying the statement generically it applies to Kodshin, and then later on it can be explaining that, you know what, the specific case of Kodshin, namely a Shlil, is actually the subject of the Machlokas of Yehuda and the Rabbanan. Now, in the course of that, though, the Gemara had assumed that you could have, that if we say these vlodis kodshim, if we say that the baby of a kodshim animal, such as a shlomim, it becomes kodish even when it's in the womb, then it comes out that the issur of the issur on the baby, the fact that it's kodshim, and you can't eat it unless it's brought to the korban and unless you tell her, and so on and so forth, is going to come at the same time as the gid, in the sense, in other words, the baby is forming in the womb, and the gid is forming along with it, and already then the gid anasha is also, and already then the animal is also because the mother is conscious. So now the Gemara asks, how could you possibly say that these two things actually develop at the same time, such that you, in other words, that as soon as, like this was saying, as soon as the baby starts forming, you should assume it already has a gid anotha, which is going to be also vahatnan. We learn in a Mishnah in Nozim. Now we know, of course, if a Nozim becomes tamei mes, then he has to forfeit the number of days that he kept of Nazirah so far, and bring certain karbanas, and shave his hair, and start all over again. Now there are many different things from a mess that can be metame, but the Mishnah establishes over there that not every tumor from a mess does a nazir have to shave and restart his naziris for. There are certain kinds of things, and even though a person is tumah mess, all the nazir needs to do is become tahor, wait 7 days, be sprinkled with paragam or water toivel, and resume his naziris from where he left off. So the Mishnah says, Ala'ilu tumas anozim agalayach. These are the tumas for which a nozir would have to shave and forfeit the days and do all and everything else. Is the first two are alames al kazayis min ames. He has to, if he was in contact with a mess or with a kazayis of a mess. Now the kashalon. Now the obvious question is, why does the Mishnah have to say both? Al kazayis min ames and galayach al kula bekoshekin. If he has to shave and restart his nazirus, even for a kezias of a mess, how much more so the entire thing? So why does the Mishnah have to tell us both? In fact, the Gemara tells us over there that a little story that one time Rabbi Yehuda was teaching in the Beis Medrash, and a Talmud of Rabbi Meir, Sunfus, came in and said this halacha over in Rabbi Meir's name with these words that al mess, al kezias min a mess, and Rabbi Yehuda is upset and says why did a mayor teach that way, and why is Sunfus supporting it that way? It seems to be unnecessary verbiage. Until Rabbi Yossi comes in and explains that so Rabbi Yossi gives an explanation of it. They're talking about, let's say, conceivably you could have a mess that has less than a kazayis of flesh on it. But then the Gemara is still not satisfied with that answer. And then, so in that Gemara over there, Volmer Rabbi Yechon, so Rabbi Yechon explains, Lo Yitzchucha, that Mishnah was only needed, only you're talking about an unborn, a stillborn baby, or not even stillborn, but a baby that died in the womb very early in the pregnancy, so early, its limbs are not yet knit together with gidim. With gidim over here would mean as we've talked about before, gidim is a kind of general term in Gemara. It includes things like ligaments and tendons and nerves and so on and so forth. So those are not even visible in the baby yet. It's such an early stage of development. So then the chiddush is that nevertheless, if a nazir were to be in contact with the remains of that baby, then he would still have to shave and so on and so forth. So that's why it says on this, and then separately kazayis from this. Choice just discusses over here, Rabbi Yochanan's statement does not actually, specifically, was not originally on that Mishnah in Nozir. To explain it, it's rather on a different Mishnah, a different Mishnah in all those. But whatever, the point is, in other words, that we see that there's an early stage, very early stage in the baby's development, and this is as far as a person, the same thing would be as far as an animal, where there's no Gidim yet. So it comes out that if you're going to say that the baby is also bahana while it's in the womb, as soon as it starts forming, well, at that point, the gid hasn't started forming yet, because the gid is only starts forming and only is detectable later on. So now you can't say that the two isurim come at the same time. So that can't be what the Mishnah wants to tell us. So if you're going to say, in other words, that mukdashin in on Mishnah means in general kodshin, meaning even already born and mature kodshin, then fine. But then we have the question that why does the Mishnah have to tell us that? Just because if you move through Makdashah, the Yidanasha was already also before, it doesn't become mutter. There's no reason to think it just become mutter because you made the animal hektish. Because you had designated the animal for a korban. And if you're going to say it's talking about a baby, then again, if you assume that the Mishnah holds that these vladis are the me'iman and kedoshim, the kodesh even while still in the womb, then it comes out. They start forming in the womb before the gid even forms. Al ne'issa mukdashin kodim. So you see that the issa of mukdashin comes first. And only then the gidim start forming later. So then what would be the point of what our Mishnah is saying? In other words, Tosfos explains that basically it all sorts out as flesh, and then some of it hardens and develops into Gideon, which, physiologically, what that means is, in other words, and they start out nerve tissue as nerve tissue. It doesn't come from, so it doesn't come from something else. But in other words, you have a stage of the development where it hasn't really formed into actual nerve tissue yet. Anyway, Tosfos gives a few other explanations. Tosfos brings from a Rashi later on, although Rosh Yosef points out that he hasn't found that Rashi that says what it means is the gid to begin with starts forming from the beginning, but it's not originally on the calf. As we started learning yesterday, there's a spoon shape, there's a rounded muscle on the thigh called the calf, the quadriceps femoris muscle, and then to begin with, the gid doesn't start forming over there. It moves into place there only later, so therefore it's not yet usher as gid anasha. Anyway, Tosfos gives a couple of other explanations of what the Gemara means. But in any case, the question is, if it's already also as Kodshim, then of course, then why should the Issu of Gid Anosha come and be Chal on Tachlit? And the answer is yes. Afagav the Issu of Mukdashin Kodim, even though the Issu of Mukdashin comes first, because we're going to take, like Rabbi Yochanan is saying, that it starts developing and only later on are they recognizable as Gidim, and we're still going to assume that our Tana holds Vladis Kodshim in Ne'iman and Kedoshim, that the baby is already also when it's in the womb, not that it first becomes also when it's born, as the father is going to bring another opinion about that later on. Nevertheless, also Issu Gid Chayiv Alayhu. Nevertheless, the Issu of Gid Anosha is able to be Chal on top of the Issu of Kodshim. Shekin Issurin, even though usually Ein Issu Chal al Issu, unless it's a stronger type of Issu, but here it's different. Shekin Issurin Noyeg B'nei Noyach, because the Issu of Gid Anosha also applies to B'nei Noyach. Now, when we say B'nei Noyach, usually, of course, throughout Chas, B'nei Noyach means all the other non-Jewish nations in the world. Here it doesn't mean that. A Goy is perfectly allowed to eat Gid Anosha. What we mean is, later on in the Masechta, later on in the Perek, we're going to talk about, when there's going to be two different opinions. When did the Gid Anosha first become Osir? The Pasuk tells us, of course, the story of the Gid Anosha and the Issur of it in Parshas Vayishlach in connection with Yaakov fighting with the Malach. Did it actually become Osir then? And already, therefore, Yaakov and his children are already not allowed to eat it? Or is it that it became Osir only when Hashem gave the Torah, and now Hashem dictates the Torah to Moshe, and he tells him, write this Pasuk over there in Parshas Vayishlach in the context of what happened with Yaakov? But in other words, according to that, it would be, I mean, the Gemara tells us a rule in Sanhedrin that if you have a mitzvah that says before Matan Torah, that's written in the Torah, and it's never repeated again, then it means it's addressed only to the Jewish people, not to the rest of the world, not to the rest of the B'nai Noyach. So when we say over here that it applies to B'nai Noyach, what we mean is to Yaakov and his family before Matan Torah, not that it applies to B'nai Noyach now. Anyway, the point is that since it applied to them, then that means, in other words, it has a stronger issur, so therefore it's able to be chal even on top of the issur of korban.
But where do we know?
Yeah,
where do we know that before Matan Torah it applies to the Jewish people only?
Well, that's because the pasuk says al pein layech l'bnei Yisrael. That's the nashim. So it's very clear it applies only to bnei Yisrael. The question is, does bnei Yisrael mean the Jewish people as an attribute in Torah, or does it mean the sons of Yisrael, also known as Yaakov, and therefore means Yaakov, and therefore means Yaakov's family even before Matan Torah?
Which is always the Jewish people.
I understand, but the point is, in other words, does it apply? Is it that there was no issue of Gidan Nosha until Matan Torah? Hashem gives the Torah, he gives 613 mitzvahs. One of them is not to eat Gidan Nosha, and Hashem tells Moshe, when you're writing it in the Torah, write it, don't write it as a regular mitzvah like all the other ones, like Gabra Hashem and Moshe Lemo, don't eat Gidan Nosha, but rather write it in the context of the story with Yaakov fighting with the Malach. So according to that, then, it would mean that there was no such issue until Matan Torah. That's the opinion of the Chachamim in a Mishnah later on in our parish. As opposed to Rabbi Yehuda, it holds that, no, it did already apply to Yaakov and his sons. It was already also from them, and therefore the Torah is actually written there in chronological order. As soon as the story happened with Yaakov, then from then on, he and his children are right away also to eat the Gidan Asher.
Uh-huh.
According to that way
of looking.
What?
Yeah. That's specific to this case, but in any other case, when it doesn't say Bnei Israel, then it applies to the Goyim?
So the rule is, the Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin like this. Obviously, any mitzvah that's given after the Torah is given is for the Jewish people. But mitzvahs before the Torah was given, for example, Milah, for example, Gidan Nosha, for example, others, the rule is, if it's repeated later on in the Torah, then it means it applies to both Jews and non-Jews. If it's not repeated again, or the Gemara explains it, even if it's repeated, but it's repeated to teach us a certain detailed din in it or something, then it applies only to Jews, not to Bnei Nayim. So here, Gidan Nosha, it says only once in the Torah, and therefore it means it applies only to Jews, as opposed to, for example, let's say the Shev Mitzvahs Bnei Noach are given in the Torah earlier in Parshas Noach, and then they're repeated, each of them is repeated in different places in the Torah, so therefore that means that it applies to both Jews and Goyim.
So if that's the case, why it has to be said twice? Is it once for the Jews and once for...
Because if it's said only once, then it would be only for us. The Torah is given to us Jewish people, but there are certain mitzvahs that the Torah gives beforehand. For example, the Torah tells us, Hashem told Noah, after they come out of the teva, that even though you're allowed to kill animals for food, you're not allowed to kill people, and anybody who does is going to be punished, and so on and so forth. So therefore, it had to be put over there to say that applies to Bnei Noah, but it's also repeated later in the Torah to say that it applies, so if it's said it only the one time in the Torah, in Parshas Noah, we would say it applies only to Jews. Hashem repeats it again in the Torah, and now that means it applies to everybody, both Jews and non-Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the point is, in other words, so the Gemara is saying over here, so given that the Gidan Nosha applied before Matan Torah as well, meaning it applied to Yaakov's sons when they still had the status of Bnei Noach, so it can be considered a powerful enough Isser to even go on top of the Isser of Kodshim. So yes, you can say that this baby in the womb is already also by virtue of the fact that its mother was a Korban, and therefore you can't just take that baby and shecht it and willy-nilly eat it. But now, on top of that, also, the issue of Gidan Nosha, when the Gidan Nosha develops in the baby, also is chal on top of that, because that's a stronger issue, because there was a time when it applied to Bnei Noach as well. But the Gemara asks, Man Shamat Lehai Svara, who do you find who holds that Svara? Rabbi Yehuda. That's Rabbi Yehuda in a Mishnah later on our parak. The problem is, V'al Masnis Sinta like Rabbi Yehuda. But our Mishnah is clearly not like Rabbi Yehuda, the Katoni, because our Mishnah had also said, Noyeg Bebehemo V'chaya, that it applies to domestic and wild animals, V'yerech She'imin V'yerech Shal Smol, and it applies both to the right thigh and to the left thigh, whereas we're going to learn on Amud Beis that Rabbi Yehuda disagrees and says it applies to only one thigh out of the two. And we're going to see which one. So clearly our mission is not like Rabbi Yehuda. So how, when it says Mukhdoshin, could that heart be like Rabbi Yehuda? And the answer is fine. Hi, Tana. The Tana of our Mishnah agrees with Rabbi Yehuda on one detail, that Gidan Nosha did apply to Bnei Noach. It wasn't a mitzvah that was newly given after Matan Torah. But he disagrees with him on another point, as far as that it's Rabbi Yehuda holds that it would apply to only one leg, and the Tana of our Mishnah holds that it applies to both. Okay. The Gemara says that's still not really good enough. Aim the Shamatha Rabbi Yehuda B'tmei. You know what? Where do you find the relevance of Rabbi Yehuda's opinion that the issue of Gidan Nosha is chomer because it applied to Bnei Noach? B'tmei. For that matter, Tosfos, by the way, points out, of course, that, you know, also the Mishnah mentions the Machlokes, the Tanakhama and Rabbi Yehuda about the Shlil. So you see also that the Tanakhama of our Mishnah is not like Rabbi Yehuda. Anyway, the point is that, but the question is, Aim the Shamatha Rabbi Yehuda. Vitzmeya. You know when you find Rabbi Yehuda saying his opinion that because it applies to Neneya and therefore it has a special status, Vitzmeya. That's when you're talking about a non-kosher species of animal. The Isur Lav. As it is, there's an Isur Lav to eat from that animal. So Rabbi Yehuda holds that the Isur of Gidan Nosha is able to be chal on it. Meaning, in other words, what would happen, so like this, we know a person eats a Gidan Nosha from a cow or a sheep or any other kosher animal in his chayav malchus. What about a person eats a Gidan Nosha from a horse? So, according to the Tanakh, according to the Chachamim, nothing, as according to the Chachamim, we would say nothing happens. He's not chayav for the Gidan Nosha because according to the Chachamim, since the mitzvah was given only after Matan Torah, and after Matan Torah, which means only kosher species, then therefore it only applies to kosher species. As far as being chayav, eating from a non-kosher species, actually, maybe he'll be chayav, maybe not, that we'll deal with later in the Perek. It gets into this question that we started talking about yesterday, yesh v'gid menosin tam, or ein v'gid menosin tam, does the gid itself actually have a flavor such that it should be considered meat? Anyway, Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. Rabbi Yehuda, who says that it applies to Bnei Noach, he says, well, before Matan Torah, the Jewish people, before Matan Torah, Yaakov and his sons were not also what kind of species they could eat. They could eat horses if they wanted. They could eat camels if they wanted. They could whatever. So therefore, there's no reason, says Rabbi Yehuda, that the issue of Gidan Nosha should not continue to apply to those animals, such that if a person were to eat the Gidan Nosha of a horse or a camel, he should indeed be chayav. So you see, Rabbi Yehuda is saying, when you have something which is already also by a lav, namely there's a lav in the Torah, not to eat a horse or a camel, then the issue of Gidan Nosha, being a stronger issue, being that it applied to Bnei Noach as well, can be chal on top of that. Because, again, because after all, in the time from Yaakov's times until Matan Torah, that was definitely the case. They could eat non-kosher species, and they just couldn't eat the Gidan Nosha, that according to him. Right. But Kodshim beats the Kodesh Mishamad, right? When you find the Kodshim, a person eats Kodshim when it's tome, when it's pigle, etc., then there can be kodesh involved. So meat shamatle, where do you find that Rabbi Yehuda holds that the issue of Gidan Nosha, which is a much lesser issue, it's only a lab, should be chal on top of that? It's not logical. So no, why should Rabbi Yehuda hold that the, why should it be, why indeed should Rabbi Yehuda hold that Gidan Nosha should be chal on top of the issue of Bekish? So the Gemara says, you know what, fine. The answer we've been trying to give all this time, that when the Mishnah says mukdoshing, it means an unborn baby in the mother's womb, no, that answer is not going to work. Rather, elahocha b'mvakeres eskinim. So we're not talking about a regular case of an animal of kodshim which is pregnant with a baby, where there the baby inherits the status of the mother and is also kodshim, and as we talked about, it's already also. Rather, what we're talking about, b'mvakeres eskinim, we're talking about an animal that's pregnant with its first baby, the berechem kodesh. Now, that when does the baby, if the baby is a male, then it's in Pahur and it has Kedusha, but when does it get that Kedusha? Only when it comes out of the womb. So now the point is that the two Isurim come at the same time. So now it's the other way around, rather. The Isur of Gidan Nosha then, the Isur of Gidan Nosha will apply to it because the Gidan Nosha forms in the baby. So it depends. If we say, so now we have the two opinions in the Mishnah, whether it applies to a shlil. If you say, like the Tanakh Kamma, that it applies to a shlil, then fine. It was already also went before the baby was even born, before it ever gained the status of a bechur. And now comes the Isur of bechur and it's chal on top of that. And that's fine because that's a stronger Isur because again, to eat a bechur which could have been brought as a korban, without bringing it as a korban, a person would be chayav paris for eating kodshim. So the stronger issue can be chal on top of the weaker issue. If you say that no, it doesn't apply to a shlil, it applies only when the baby is born, then fine, you would say the two issurim come at the same time. The moment the baby is born, the Gidan Nosha, going to the Yehuda, the Gidan Nosha becomes also, and in addition, now it also gains the status of the chor. So that would be what the Mishnah is talking about. But even though it's true, Gidan Nosha may not apply to other Kodshim because they're already also as Kodshim, they can't become more also because of the Gidan Nosha. And as we said, it's certainly not logical to say that because they became Kodshim, the issue of Gidan Nosha should go away. But there is a type of Kodshim where Gidan Nosha will fully apply, where a person will in fact get Malchus for eating this Gidan Nosha, namely by Bachar. Okay, so that's an answer. The Borisema, or another answer you could say, Bechlal, you're assuming all this time the Mishnah is saying that a baby of Kodshim is Kodesh already in the womb. Maybe not. For what does Kodshim Bava Yosin Hem Kodoshim? The babies of Kodshim, the babies of Kodshim become Kodesh only when they're born. Bava Yosin literally means when they come to be. Rashi explains it, since we learn the concept of what is kodshim from a pasuk that says, "Asher yiyu l'cha," that will be to you. So therefore, the Gemara uses the expression "have a yosem" from the same shoresh to mean they're being, they're being born. So in other words, therefore, according to that, yes, the issue of Gid HaNasha will apply to all babies of Kodshim, not just the Bechor, like we just said, because since it comes into effect, only since, so again, if you say that the Tanakhama of our mission, that the issue of Gid HaNasha applies even when the baby is in the womb, well, then the issue of Gid HaNasha already exists. And now, when it's born, the issue of Gid HaNasha applies to that, and then it doesn't go away. Or if you say like Rabbi Yehuda, it doesn't go away when the baby is born and becomes Kodshim. Or you could say that, if you go like Rabbi Yehuda, that doesn't apply to a Shlil, then the two Yisurim come at the same time, the moment the baby is born, and now gains the status of Kodshim, then is also the moment when the Gid HaNasha becomes also appointed Rabbi Yehuda. So that would be the Chiddush of the mission. Okay. Now that we've established that the issue of Gid HaNasha does apply to Kodshim, let's talk about which Kodshim. I'm going to pray by Yosef. Lo shanu ala Kodshim. The point is, in other words, that you shouldn't think, Tosfos says, you shouldn't think that the issue of Kodshim, which is a more stringent issue, is maybe overriding the issue of Gid HaNasha, that's lighter, and therefore it shouldn't be chal together with it. Nevertheless, the two students at the same time, and therefore both of them are equally chal. So now, a person were to eat from this Gid HaNasha, he'd be chayav malchus, and if he ate it as part of the rest of the animal, then he'd also be chayav malchus or chayav malchus, as the case may be, for eating Kodshim. So now, again, which Kodshim are we talking about? Omer Abchir by Yosef, Lo Shonu Ela Kodshim HaNecholim. This whole rule that the issue of Gid HaNasha will still apply to the Kodshim only applies to Kodshim that can be eaten. Most Kodshim, most Korbanos, as we know, can be eaten. So now, if a person eats the Gid HaNasha of them, then he's going to be Chayav Malchus for it. Aval Kodshim She'en Necholim. But when you have Kodshim that are not eaten, particularly in Ula, then ain't Issa Gid Noeg Behem, then says Rav Chiya bar Yosef, the Issa of Gid HaNasha will not apply to them. But Rav Yochanan Omer, Echad Kodshim HaNachon, Echad Kodshim HaNachon, Issa Gid Noeg Behem, whereas Rav Yochanan says either way, the Issa of Gid HaNasha is going to apply, and a person will be Chayav Malchus for eating it. Omer Rav Papa, V'loi Pligi. So Rav Papa says, you know what, actually, they're not actually arguing, Kan Lahal Koisei, Kan Lahal Loisei. There's whether you give him malchus for it or whether you bring it up onto the mizbeach. Namely, when Rav Chiya bar Yosef is saying that the issue of Gid HaNasha does not apply to Kodshim She'en Necholim to an Ola, what he means is there's no issue to bring that Gid HaNasha on the mizbeach. So in other words, with a shlomim and a chatas and the rest of the edible korbanos, it's irrelevant. You're not bringing the thigh of that onto the mizbeach anyway. But an oila with the thigh together with the rest of them is brought on the mizbeach. Rav Chiya bar Yosef is saying there's no problem to bring the thigh as it is intact with the Gid HaNasha and burn it all on the mizbeach. That would be lahal oisa. Whereas Rav Yochanan is saying, well, how could he say, give him malchus if he eats the Gid HaNasha, and then that would apply even if the person eats the Gid HaNasha, even of an Ola, then he would be over and he'd be getting malchus. So in other words, Rav Chiya bar Yosef would agree with that. So in other words, both of them agree that you would be getting malchus, and both of them agree that you would bring it out of the mizbeach. They're just Rav Chiya bar Yosef is saying that practically speaking, the issue of bringing it up to onto the mizbeach doesn't apply to other kodshim. It only applies to an ola, whereas Rav Yochanan is saying it applies either way. That's the point of Rashi. The Ran gives a Ran asks, so, I mean, the fact that he would get malchus in the Gid HaNasha is poshut. Why would Rav Yochanan have to be telling us that? So he says, Lahal Koisei means if a person brought up the Gid HaNasha on the mizbeach, then Rav Yochanan would say that in fact, if he brings it onto the mizbeach, so now if a person eats it after it was brought up onto the mizbeach, then nevertheless he's not eating, he's not getting malchus for bringing it onto the mizbeach, even though you're not allowed to eat it. But Rav Yochanan would say you're not allowed to eat it. And as the Gemara is going to talk about soon, you may not be allowed to bring it onto the mizbeach, because the rule is you can bring on the mizbeach only things that are kosher for a Jew to eat. Nevertheless, Rav Yochanan would say you don't get malchus for it. So he would say, the issue of Gid HaNasha applies there, but nevertheless, he's not getting malchus for bringing it on him as there. So that's one. If again, we another version of what the Papa says. I'm going to Papa Vloitzli, Hamachalzai Kamahalot, Vakamahalosi. Another version of what the Papa says is the argument between them is, do you have to extract it? Do you have to take it out of the leg? Or can you bring it up and can you bring it up onto the mizbeach after? So the priya would so now Rashi says two explanations of the second version of Rapaz. If you say it doesn't apply to an oila, then that means you don't have to take it out of the oila. Just bring up the whole leg intact onto the mizbeach and burn it back. Whereas according to Rav Yochanan, he says, no, it would mean you're not allowed to bring up the Gidon Rasha. If it was taken out of the thigh, you cannot bring it up onto the Mizbeach, and you cannot burn it here. That's one way of explaining the second version of what a Papa says. Then also we'll talk in a second when another what the other gives is Rav Nachman Yitzchok Amar Lahal Lo Siplugi. Rav Nachman Yitzchok says that the only machlokas is whether to bring it up. Should you bring it up in the thigh or should you cut it out of the thigh first? So the Priya by Yosef would be saying that it doesn't apply to Kodesh and Nefilim, so it's fine. Bring up the thigh with the Gid HaNosha in it. Rav Yochanan would hold that you're not allowed to bring up the thigh even with the Gid HaNosha in it. So in other words, according to the first version of Rav Papa, we would say that noyeg means that you're not allowed to even bring it up at all. And according to Rav Yochanan, you could. So on the side over here, and I go to Yonim, it points out that there were the geusa over here is not the geusa over here seems to be a little bit mixed up. It seems that the geusa should really be. Rav Nachman Yitzchok says, the machlokas is, do you have to take it out, or can you just bring up the whole leg intact? In any case, the point is, in other words, so we're not necessarily, so there is a machloikas. So when a prophet says, well, it doesn't mean there's no machloikas at all. He means everybody would agree that malchus applies, whether it's an oilo or whether any other thing, but you have different ways of looking at, can you bring up the Gid HaNosha on from Isaiah? Do you have to cut it out of the leg? What about if you can you bring up the leg intact? Or even with it intact, you still can't offer the Gid HaNosha on the Mizbeach and you have to take it out. The Tanya, as in fact we learn in a Braisa, about the subject, about the Gid HaNosha. The pasuk is v'hitzur ha-kohen es ha-kol ha-mizbeach. The kohen should burn everything on the mizbeach by an oiler. Now, what does it mean, ha-kol? L'rabasav somasagidin v'akanayim v'aklafayim. It comes to include bones and gidim and the horns and the hooves. Those are all, even though those are not edible parts of the animal, nevertheless, you still burn them on the mizbeach. Continues the Braisa, yochel afil peshu. You would think that would apply even if they were separated from the body of the animal. No, Talmud Lomar. Therefore, you have a different passage that also talks about an oila. V'asisa oilas sefa bosav adam. You should perform your oilas, and you should bring your oilas the flesh and the blood, implying that only the flesh and blood goes on the mizbeach and nothing else. So we see that, so what is that? So it means, in other words, that, now horns and hooves and so forth are not included in that, and therefore it means if they're separated from the animal, then you don't in fact bring them on the mizbeach. But the Braisa continues, eat boss of Adam, but now that we have this pasuk that mentions only flesh and blood, yocho yachlet gibim vachsomers, the yala boss of the gabim mizbeach, so you think maybe you have to take out all the gibim and all the bones and bring up only the meat onto the mizbeach. Well, that's why you have the first pasuk that says the kohen should offer everything on the mizbeach. Okay, so what is it? Do you bring the other parts or not? So that's why Mufaborin Yalu. If they're all connected, then you bring them. So you don't take the meat off the bones. But if for whatever reason the meat was taken off, so if you don't take off the meat from the bones, you bring up all onto the mizbeach and burn them that way. But if the meat was separated from the bones, then you don't bring up the bones to the mizbeach. Pirshu, after the Berosh Hashem Mizbeach, and if they were separated from the flesh, even if it was at the top of the Mizbeach, Yodu, then you take the bones off the Mizbeach, and you don't burn them. So that's how you reconcile the two Pesukim. So we see therefore that the Braisa is saying you don't take out the Gidim, but if the Gidim was separated, then you don't offer them on the Mizbeach. So that would fit with what we were talking about over here, according to the Papa, and according to the Nachman Yitzchak. that Apriya and Rabbi Yochanan, that part of the discussion between Apriya and Rabbi Yochanan is, do you in fact have to take out the Gidan Nasha, or can you offer it whole? And what happens if it was separated from what happens if it was taken out? Can you offer it on the Mizbech? So the Gemara points out, Mantana, the Shamat Leid Omar, well, which Tana is it that we find that we say if bones or any of these other inedible parts are detached from the korban, then you take them off the mizbeach? Rebbe, necessarily that's the opinion of Rebbe. The Tanya, as we learn in another braisa, which is going to go over the same kind of thing again, which Tosfos wonders in that case, what was the point of bringing the first braisa? So Tosfos explains that there's a chidush in that first braisa compared to the second one, which we'll learn, but other Mephoshim point out that that's just the style of the Gemara sometimes. The Gemara will like to bring a braisa, even if we're not learning anything new from it, because anyway, the Ramban explains that sometimes the Gemara will bring a braisa, which otherwise would be unnecessary, because we want to demonstrate who the author of that braisa is. So the Tanya, we learn in Braisa, again, when the Pasuk says the Hikta Akoin is a call, the Pasuk says the Kohen should burn everything. So then that comes to include the bones and gidim and horns and the flesh. Now this Braisa says differently. Even if they separated from the flesh, then you still have to bring them on them as dead. So what is that pasuk about bringing the olos, the flesh and the blood, mean? If it sounds like it means that you bring only the flesh and the blood. That would be the poikin. That would be when they if they jump off the mizbeach, if they boost off the mizbeach. We learn in Zvachin, sometimes you have something that's bruning on the mizbeach and it has a high water content or something, and therefore like it explodes off the mizbeach. So with those there's a difference between flesh and anything else. Okay, so what does that mean? He called it buster at the maxim. It means when you have burnt flesh or partially burnt flesh from the carbon, and now it does that, if it explodes and jumps off the mizbeach, then you have to put it back on the mizbeach. So you have to maxim fully gidim basomas, but if the same thing happens with gidim or with bones, then you don't have to put them back on the mizbeach. That's the opinion of the Tanakhama. Rebbe says no. After all, you have one pasuk that says the Koyan should offer everything. That's a ribui, that means that everything that belongs to the animal. But then you have, when it says only habosav adam, then you have a mir. Okay, so what does that mean? How do you reconcile the two positions? So like we said in the first braisa, if there's still attached to the rest of the animal, then you bring them up onto the mizbeach. Perishu, and if they separated after the Bredosha from his Be'ach Yerudu, then even if it's on top of them, his Be'ach, you take them down. So we see that the first Braisa, which just mentioned that point, is a point of Rebbe. And again, what was the point of bringing the first Braisa? So Tosfos explains that if it weren't for the first Braisa, you would think that the Chachamim would say even if Perishu, then you always include everything, and the only thing is when it comes to poikim, where it was already placed on the mizbeach and burnt, and now some of it fell off, then you can distinguish between different things, whereas Rebbe would talk about only if they were removed, only perishu, things of isuri, things of isuri, such as the gidan nafa. So the first braisa helps clarify that it's not so, there's no difference between isuri and heter. In that regard, it's strictly a difference of, according to Rebbe, any of the non-flesh parts, if they were detached before the animal, before it was burnt on the mizbeach, then you take them off the mizbeach. And according to the Chachamim in the second braisa, that it has nothing to do with that. It has to do with that those who always leave on the mizbeach, no matter whether they were detached from the animal or not, it's just a difference of whether, if they're partially burnt and fell off the mizbeach, after you put them back. Okay, so that's what the Gemara says. But Rabbanon, what about according to the Rabbanon? What do they do with Rebbe's Drasha? They say, it's your brother Rabbuya. You don't need a pasuk to tell us that everything that's attached you bring onto the mizbeach. Maybe to have it Rosh Hashanah, because after all, the Chacham would say, it's no different than the head of an Ola. The head of an Ola, now you have to bring the head intact on the mizbeach. The pasuk clearly says so. And the head has lots of bones in it. The skull, which is made out of several bones, and nevertheless you bring it on the mizbeach. So there's no question if it's attached, then you bring it. So the only reason why you need a pasuk is when they got separated from it, and that then the pasuk is telling us that even then you still burn them on the mizbeach. So that's what you learn from the Hikta HaKoyin HaKol, that whether poshu or whether not, then you still burn them on the mizbeach. The Rebbe, was it? So they say, because again, if it was not poshu, then there's no chiddush, of course. It's like you offer the head, you would offer any other inedible part that's still attached. the Rebbe, what would Rebbe answer to that? He would say, "Mechuponim dehatera, well, it's just korah." On the contrary, though, what Rebbe would say that if it's something that's attached, that's mutter, then you're right. You don't need a pasuk. You don't need the pasuk. The hikter akoyanus akoyanus kolam is based to tell us that you offer it. Obviously, again, like you say, like the chachamim say, you can learn that from the head. What does the pasuk need to tell us about the gidan nosha when it's still attached? So now, therefore, the pasuk is telling us that nevertheless, when it's attached, then you still bring it onto the mizbeach. So again, when we said before in Rabbi Chiya by Yosef and Rabbi Yochanan that we're discussing the question, do you have to lachaltsay or lahal? You have to take it out before you bring it up onto the mizbeach. Lahal loisay, can you bring it up onto the mizbeach? So Rebbe would say that you don't have to lachaltsay, you don't have to take it out. Bring it up to the mizbeach as is. That you're learning from Hakol. The Rabbanon would answer that. No, you cannot bring the Gidan Nosha onto the Mizbeach, because the Pasuk says about Korbanos, Mi Mashke Yisrael. The Pasuk says in Yechezkel, when he's describing the Korbanos, in the third base of Mikdash, he mentions that the Korbanos are brought Mi Mashke Yisrael, which literally means from the drinks of the Jewish people. And that means, the Gemara learns from that in Pesachim and in other places in Shas, that it means that to bring on, to what's brought on the Mizbeach, to offer to Hashem, has to be something that's mutter for a Jew to eat. From that we learn that you can't, among other things, you can't bring a shefer as a korban. We learn from that, let's say, you can't bring wine of Orla as Nesachim, and then in many other limudim that we learn from that, that anything that's also for a Yid to eat is also to bring on the Mizbeach. Well then, the Chacham said the Gidan Nosha is also for a Yid to eat, therefore you can't bring it on the Mizbeach. So yes, the Chacham say you would necessarily have to take it out before you, that you would have to take it out before you bring it onto the Mizbeach. As far as the Pasuk, the Ribui in the Pasuk is in fact telling us not the Gidan Nosha, because that's also to eat, but rather all the other parts that are attached, that those you bring up on the Mizbeach, whether they're attached or detached. Again, they learn from Hakol, but it means even not just if they're attached. They said there's no Chiddush in that. Obviously, if you bring the head, which is still attached together, then the same thing. You bring any other part, that's a complete organ, but even if the bones or hooves or whatever were detached, then you still bring them because of the possibly through our Korinus Hakol Mizbecha. And they're telling Rebbe, you want to learn from Hakol that includes also the Gidan Nosha? No, because the Gidan Nosha is also to eat. For Rebbe, what would Rebbe answer back to that? He says, so what? Midin have a chelev adam. So why would it be any different than chelev and blood? A yid's not allowed to eat chelev, a yid's not allowed to eat blood, and yet you bring those onto the Mizbeach. So what does it mean? I mean, I agree with the drosha, Yimashke Yisrael, that in order to bring a korban, it has to be something that's mutter to the Jewish people. That means, for example, not a trefa or earl or other such things like that, but something that's part of the, something that came as part of the flesh itself, then you bring it. So the same way as you bring the chelev, or as part of the growing animal, the same way now you can also bring the Gidan Nosha for the same reason. But Rabbanon, where's the Rabbanon answer that? The difference is mitzvot and mitach. The difference is chelev and dam. There's a specific mitzvah to bring them. They're the main thing of the korban is to sprinkle the blood and to burn the chelev. As for mitzvot and mitach shiny, it's different when the mitzvah is specifically to do that, to offer the chelev and the blood. But the Gidan Nosha, there's no specific mitzvah to offer, and therefore the Chacham say the usual rule of mimashki yisrael should apply. And since the Gidan Nosha is also to eat, then it's also to bring as a korban. So it comes out, in other words, again, the whole point that we were talking about with the different versions of what Rav Papa said and what Rav Nachman Yitzchak said, where the machlokas between Rav Chiya bar Yosef and Rav Yochanan, where in some versions we said the machlokas is, can you bring up the Gidan Nosha within the leg, or do you have to remove it? And what about if it was detached? What about if it was removed from the leg? Can you bring it on the Mizbeach? Then it comes out, it's subject to this machlokas of Rebbe. It comes out that it dovetails with this machlokas of Rebbe and Chacham. Going to Rebbe, you can bring the Gidan Nosha on the Mizbeach, but only if it's attached, if it's still within the leg. If you were to take it out of the leg, then Rebbe would say, the same way as you don't bring a bone that was taken out of the leg, the same way you wouldn't bring the Gidan Osher either. Whereas the Chachamim are saying, nothing doing, you don't take it out, even if it's attached. You have to detach it and remove it from the leg. As far as the bones, the Chachamim are going to say, on the contrary, whether they're attached or not, you can still offer them on the Mizbeach. Okay. So let's talk more about this point, what we do with the Gidan Osher. Again, now when it comes to the Gidan Osher of other korbanos that are eaten, then it's not really an issue. Because whoever's going to eat the thigh is going to have to remove the Gidan Osher. Obviously, as we said before, Gidan Osher does apply to Kodshin, so obviously it's going to have to be removed. An interesting thing worth mentioning in that connection, by the way, is in connection with the Kurd and Pesach, which has to be roasted whole. The Rambam learns you roast it whole, gidah nasha and all. And just as you're eating, you take out the gidah nasha and you take out the various other chalev and various other things that are supposed to be taken out. The Raven very, very sharply argues with that and says, what are you talking about? You're going to roast the animal whole with the gidah nasha and fat around it, which we're going to learn later on. The fat is also by a minig yisrael, and you're going to, with all the other fats in the animal, all the other chaylev, which is then going to be, as we're going to learn later on, in the parak mefapeh and makula, it's going to penetrate throughout the whole rest of it and give it a flavor of Isser. Of course you have to take it out. And the Ravid says, you know what, if I have a source to eat a korban pesach, and they bring me one prepared, like the Rambam says, I'm going to throw it on the ground. I wouldn't eat such a thing. So it's machlokas between the Rambam and the Ravid, what you do about that. There's the chaylev and the Rambam explain that Rambam doesn't have such a problem with that. The gidah nosha itself, it doesn't give a flavor, as we said before, in the gidah minosin tam. The fat around it is not such a problem. Fine, at most you take out a layer of the meat around it. Same thing with the chaleb. As it is, you're talking about a yuling animal that doesn't have a lot of fat anyway, so there's various ways to make it work, according to the Rambam. Okay, but anyway, so when it comes to korbanos that are eaten, then it's not an issue what we do with the gidah nosha, because obviously you have to take it out. The question is, what about an oila? That's what we're talking about all this time, because an oila is completely burnt animals there, so what do you do as far as its gidah nosha? So I'm going to go gidah nosha shel oila chotze latapuach, the gidah nosha of korban oila, you do take it out of the leg before you burn it, and you throw it onto the tapuach. Tapuach basically means, tapuach literally means an apple. Rashi points out that the word tapuach in Gemara terminology is any kind of rounded heap, anything where you have a pile of something and like you scoop up and then rake up the things around it to make one big rounded heap is called a tapuach. So you have a pile of ashes in the middle of the mizbeach. They would have every day they're burning korbanos on the mizbeach, and then every day the Mishnah and Talmud describes they would go and rake up the ashes from the mizbeach into the central pile, and every so often then they would put the ashes into a big pot and carry them outside of Yerushalayim to deposit them. So now the gidah nosha is also placed on the tapuach, says Ravuna. Omer of Chista. So Rav Chista says, I don't understand. Mori Dechi, master of this, meaning you, Rav Huna, who has made this statement, explain what you're saying. What's the problem with bringing the gidah nosha as a korban? Miksiv, al kein lo yirchal on mizbeach. The pasuk doesn't say that the mizbeach can't eat the gidah nosha. Al kein lo yirchal b'nei Yisrael ksiv. It says that b'nei Yisrael can't eat the gidah nosha. So what's the problem with burning it on the mizbeach that you're saying that you have to take it out and put it on the tapuach? So Rav Huna would answer, like we just said, Mimashki Yisrael, because the pasuk says that korbanos have to be something that Jews could eat or drink, and Jews can't eat the gidah nosha. So minam muto the Yisrael, we learned from that, has to be something that's muto for Jews to eat. So therefore, so Rav Huna says there's a very good reason to say that you should in fact take out the gidah nosha before you burn the korban. The Gemara says, "Maisi." Now I have a contradiction. A Braisa says, "Gidah nosha shel shlomim." The gidah nosha of a korban shlomim mechabde la'ama. You don't have to worry that it's left over as noiser, and you don't have to burn it like noiser. Rather, mechabde la'ama, you can sweep it into the ama. The ama was a water channel that ran through the azara. In particular, we know when we say the seder korban pesach and erev pesach, we talk about how they would use that to the water from that to clean the azara. They would stop it up, let it flood the floor, and then drain it, and all the blood and everything would go with it. So the way it was running through the Azara all the time. So now, when it comes to the gidah nosha of a shlomim, you don't have to burn it like the rest of noiser. Instead, you can sweep it in there. V'shal oila ma'alehu, whereas the one of a korban oila, you bring it up onto the mizbeach. So that seems to contradict what Rav Huna said. Now, what do we mean the gidah nosha of a shlomim? Rashi says, wait a minute though. A shlomim, why would you be cutting it up in the Azara in the first place? A shlomim is kodshim kalim. You can eat it anywhere in the city of Yerushalayim. So Rashi says, no, the gusa shouldn't be shal shlomim, it should be shal chatas for oshim. A chatas or an oshim, which are kodshim, can be eaten only in the Azara. So therefore, of necessity there, they're going to have to be cutting up the leg and taking out the gidah nosha over there. So that's one answer. Rashi says another possibility is fine. You're not talking about specifically. We know the kohenim are given certain parts of a shlomim. One of them being the parts that they receive are the chos of a shoyt, the breast and the thigh of the animal. Well, very well then. The shoyt may well now the gidah nosha technically is on the yerech, is on the upper part of the leg, but nevertheless, you know, they receive the shoyt. and therefore so it has part of the Gidan Noshe in it. Now Rashi points out, so now it's true again, it's true the Chos V'Shoik of the Shloim can be eaten anywhere in Yerushalayim. However, in a practical matter, the Kohenim spent most of their time in the Bais HaMikdash, so we could justify the Girsa Shloim, although again Rashi says maybe it would be better to say Chatas and Osham would be the correct Girsa. Tosfos also endorses Rashi's second explanation and says that, yeah, we are talking about the Chos V'Shoik, which are given to the Kohenim, and again, they would typically eat them in the Azara. Also, Tosfos points out it could be talking about if a Kohen himself brings a Shloim. Yeah, again, even though he could eat it anywhere near Shloim, in practice, they would tend to eat it in the Azara. So now, so the point is, the Braisa is saying, but the one of an Ola, so the one of a Shlomim, or according to Rashi's preferred Girsa, of a Chatas and Asham, you can't eat it, but you don't have to burn it as noisir, because not flesh. Instead, you can just sweep it into the Amma, and it goes in, and then it goes with the water flow, and exits the Bais HaMikdash that way. But the Shal Ola Ma'aleu, but one of a Korban Ola, you offer it onto the Mizbeach. My lab, Ma'aleu Umaktudit. Doesn't that mean you bring it up onto the Mizbeach, and you burn it? Not like Rav Huna. And the answer is no. No, what it means is you bring it up onto the Mizbeach, but then you have to take it out of the fire before you burn the curve, before you take the leg and throw it on the fire and burn it. So the Gemara asks, Ma'afa Shecholtzei, Lama Ma'aleu? Well, then why, if you're going to have to take it out anyway, why are you bringing it up onto the Mizbeach with the Gid HaNoshe inside in the first place? And the answer is, Mishum Shenema, because as the Pasuk says, would you offer it to your governor? This is the Navi Malachi telling the Jewish people of his times, and for all times, since it's the Nebuah that was written for us, that you can't bring substandard things to Hashem. He says people are bringing defective animals and sickly animals and whatever. And he says, listen, if you were bringing a present to your governor, would you bring him such a thing? No, he would be very insulted. How dare you bring such a thing to Hashem? And we learn from that a general concept that you can't bring something substandard or whatever to Hashem, so that you have to bring it as nicely as possible. Well, then, therefore, so if you were to cut up the leg, it wouldn't look as nice when you bring it up onto the Mizbeach. Therefore, you have to bring it up onto the Mizbeach, so to speak, presenting it to Hashem intact. Then, because of Mimashki Yisrael, then you have to remove it, but you do that right there on the top of the Mizbeach. Okay, so the Gemara says, Tanya Kavasei Rav Huna. In fact, we learn another Braise exactly like Rav Huna. Gid HaNoshe Shel Shlomim, the Gid HaNoshe of a Shlomim, or the Chatas and an Oshem, the Chabde La'ama, you don't have to worry about brewing it as noisir. You sweep it into the Amma, into the water channel, and it ends up draining out into Nachal Kidron, east of Yerushalayim. And the one of an Ola, you have to extract it and put it on the Tapuach, on the pile of ashes, and on the heap of ashes in the middle of the Mizbeach, exactly as Rav Huna had said. Having mentioned the Tapuach, so now the Gemara digresses to talk about something else about it. Tananhos, and we learn in the Mishnah in Sefer Tamid, Tapuach Hoya Be'emtza Mizbeach, in the middle of the Mizbeach was a Tapuach, this heap of ashes. Sometimes there was so much ashes over there, sometimes there were 300 kor over there. A kor is a unit of volume, it's equal to 30 saw. Translating it into, if you were to translate it into an equivalent amount of water or something like that, it would come out to about 500 pounds, give or take, according to different poskim. So now, ashes, of course, are a lot lighter, but of course, a measure of volume, but the point is that 300 kor would be an enormous amount. So Rava says this is actually an exaggeration. They would never let it pile up so much that there was 300 kor over there. There is an interesting idea that on the website, the Daf Yomi Advancement Forum, they bring an interesting chat from a Yid named Rabbi Yisrael David Slutsky, who passed away a few years ago. He says that even though Rava was saying it's a guzma, still the Chacham didn't just randomly pick a number out of thin air. What they meant was if you calculate the surface area of the Mizbeach, the total maximum area that in principle would be available for ashes, it comes out, once you look at the dimensions of the Mizbeach and the Sefer Midas and make certain adjustments over there, it comes out to 26 by 26 amas, which is 676 square amas. So if you were to have ashes piled to a height of one amma over there, then you would have 676 cubic ammas of ashes. You have to subtract one because you need a fire on the Mizbeach always. So you're going to subtract one cubic amma to allow space for the fire, leave 675. Now, a kor is equal Now a quarter is equal to two and a quarter cubic cubic hours. So 300 times 2 1/4 equals 675. So in other words, hypothetically, if the Mizbeach was actually covered on its entire surface, with the exception of one small area for the fire, with all with ashes to a height of one amma, then it would equal 300 kor. So it's an interesting chaf, although it may not really work so well because the top of the Mizbeach was not exactly 26. It was 26 and a fraction. The Kronis themselves went on amma high. They were 5 trochim high. So it's an interesting idea, but maybe it works, maybe not. But anyway, Rava is saying the fact is that in Guzma, they never actually allowed the pile of ashes on the Mizbeach to get so large. Here's other examples of the Guzma. Here's other examples where you find something where the Chacham exaggerate. Also in the Sefer Tamid, it says Hishkus of Tamid because Shalzahav, before the Shechtim, the sheep for the Korban Tamid, they would give it to drink water from a golden cup. So they're giving it to drink. The Gemara mentions at the end of Beitza that it makes it easier. It makes a certain thing after the Shechita easier. Different Mephoshim on the Gemara over there explain either it makes that the skin is now easier to strip off the animal as they have to do with the Korban, or different explanation is that it makes that there are less likely to be sirchus in the lungs, like we learned about extensively earlier in our Masechta. So you give it a drink, fine, but the fact that they give it, the fact that the Mishnah says they were given a golden cup, so Omer Rava, Guzma Rava says that's also an exaggeration. They wouldn't use gold to give a drink to an animal. They would use some other material. So the Gemara continues. Omer Rav Ami, so Rav Ami says, you know, Dibra Torah, Loshen Havai. Even the Torah itself sometimes uses exaggerated expressions. Dibra Nevi'im Lashon Havai, we find the Nevi'im also use exaggerated expressions. Dibra Chachamim Lashon Havai, and we find that the Chachamim also, in other words, it's a style. Sometimes people talk like that. People don't always speak in the most literal sense. Sometimes people will use a figure of speech even though it's exaggerated. So here's an example. Dibra Chachamim Lashon Havai Hodamaran. We just said that the Chachamim in at least two places, use Lashon Havai when talking about the amount of ashes that could be on the Mizbeach, or that they would use a golden cup to water the Talmud before they shed it. Dibra Torah Lashon Havai, where we see the Torah uses an exaggerated expression, as you have in this week's parasha. Odin Moshe tells them, you're coming into Eretz Yisrael, you're going to see over there cities that are great and fortified in the heavens. Now, cities are not fortified in the heaven, and cities are down here on earth. So it's an exaggerated expression, meaning it was like the, when you stand on the ground, you look up at them, it looks like they reach up all the way to the heavens. An interesting point that the Tiferes Yaakov brings up is you have the same expression also earlier in Chumash Devarim as well, in Parshas Devarim, when the Meraglim are telling the Jewish people what they saw in Eretz Yisrael, they also mention Orim Gerlos of Tzuras HaShemayim. So is the Gemara referring maybe to that passage? So he says maybe not, because that doesn't show the Torah uses Lashon Havai, because there is the Meraglim speaking. So you could say the Meraglim said that way, and the Torah quotes them. So I've heard him talk about this, so the very fact the Torah quotes them, maybe the Gemara is referring to that. The Rebbe points out, though, interestingly, that it can't be the Gemara is referring to that passage, because if the Meraglim had actually said Orim Gerlos of Tzuras HaShemayim as an exaggeration like that, then Kolev and Yeshua should have called him out on it. Here, Kolev and Yeshua are contradicting them and saying, don't think we can't go into Eretz Yisrael. We will be able to. If they had said an expression like Orim Gerlos of Tzuras HaShemayim, then Yeshua and Kolev would have immediately said, look at that, you're lying. There's no cities in Shemayim. So the fact that they didn't means that it explains that evidently the Meraglim didn't actually use those words. Moshe is just paraphrasing later on when he quotes them, and therefore, in fact, we could say that the Gemara of Azir is referring to either one, the Pasuk in Parshas Devarim or the one in Parshas Eitay. On a deeper level, Aruch Chaim HaKadosh, I think, points out that, in a sense, the cities are fortified in heaven, in the sense that the Malachim over there, of the Sorim of these nations are there in heaven, and Hashem is going to help you defeat them too. But still, in the simple sense, it's Lashon Havai, it's an exaggerated expression because the cities themselves are not in heaven. And Dibra Nevi'im Lashon Havai, and the Nevi'im also spoke in exaggerated expressions, as we find also described when there was a tremendous celebration when they crowned Shlomo as king, that he Baka Oretz L'Kolam, or B'Kolam, it actually says in the passage, the ground split with their noise. Now, it didn't literally split, but it means it's an exaggerated expression. It was so noisy and so loud, the celebration, that it was as if the earth was splitting open. There was an interesting vote from Menachem Azariah Misano that says that the word Havai over here in the Gemara, here in the printed Gemara, it's written as Havai, Hei Vov Aleph Yud, but it's really supposed to be, it says on the side, Havai with a Vase, Hei Vase Aleph Yud. It means an exaggeration. But the Ramah Misano points out that Havai is also a Rosh HaTevis of the words of a phrase from the pasuk. Right now I can't remember what the phrase is. I can't remember right now what the phrase is. It'll come to me. But anyway, the point is, in other words, that something about praising Hashem. Some pasuk that refers to praising Hashem. So therefore, the message of it is that even though on the face of it it's lashon havai, it seems to be just the kind of exaggeration that people are always prone to. Nevertheless, there is actually a deeper meaning in it. That havai with this lashon havai, we're praising Hashem as we're praising Hashem as we learn Torah. So the Gemara continues. Hinei Baruch Hu Hashem. That's what it is. He says it stands for Hinei Baruch Hu Hashem. Behold, now bless Hashem. So even these lashon havai, even seemingly exaggerated expressions, are actually a blessing to Hashem in the Torah that we learn. And again, there's a reason, there can be deeper reasons for these exaggerations, like we just said, as far as owning Jodos of Surah Special Mind, but at least on the surface, they did. But in other words, when we learn them on the surface, we should realize they're not just meaningless exaggerations, they're part of the praise of Hashem that is the Torah. So the Gemara continues, there were three places where the Chachamim spoke in Lashon Havai. Elohim, Tapuach, Geffen, Uparodos. As far as the tapuach that we said before, as far as the golden grapevine, and as far as the parodias. And the Gemara is going to quote and explain the other two. In other words, the point is, Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Nachmani disagrees with what we said before. Rava had said that as far as the giving the tamid to drink with a golden cup, Rava had said that's a gozma, it's an exaggeration. Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Nachmani, they were saying, no, it's not an exaggeration. They actually did use a gold cup, Ein Anius, Mokam Asheros, in the place of the ultimate riches, the Bes Mikdash, which is the house of Hashem, who owns everything in the world. The Akesta for the Azav, you don't do things by halves. Yes, they're going to use a golden cup over there, even though it's talking about giving water to an animal to drink. But he says there's two other, as far as the Tapuach, and there's two other places where, in fact, the Chacham exaggerated. So Tapuach Hodamon, the Tapuach we said, where the Mishnah says that sometimes that there could be as much as 300 kor of ashes, and there never was that much. Geffen, what about the grapevines? It's not. The Mishnah says in Midas, Geffen Shalzav Hoysa and Medis, Al Pischa Shalachal, there was a golden grapevine standing in front of the entrance of the Hegel, Umudla Gabit Fonsis, and it was trellised on poles, meaning the same way as like a real grapevine would be, sometimes you can just let the grapevine drag all over the ground. We learned in Menachos, that's what they do, that's what they would do with the vineyards from which they got wine for the Nesachim. But a lot of times vintners will instead train the vine to grow on a framework or a wall or something like that. So here they have the same thing. They had it trained and trellised on a framework of poles. B'chol mishrei misnad of garger, anybody who wanted to donate an individual golden grape or eshkol or a cluster of golden grapes, maybe the tolaba, then he would bring it and he would hang it on there. So this way he could donate to the Bes Mikdash and beautify the Bes Mikdash, and every so often the Kohen would clear off the golden grapes and then leaves and whatnot and melt them down and use the gold for the needs of the Bes Mikdash. Amr Rav Elazar Rav Tzadik, and Rav Elazar Rav Tzadik says, "Ma'is Sahoyev Nimnu Ala Shloish Ma'is Koyin." The Fanoisa. It happened once that they had to appoint 300 Koyinim to clear it, to take all the gold off it. Now again, that's a guzma. If it was that heavy that it needed 300 Koyinim to carry, then they wouldn't wait that long before they clear it, and it would break under the weight. So no, that's also a guzma. Sometimes it was a very large number of Koyinim, but not necessarily that many. This golden grapevine, by the way, was so famous, and even in the Goyisha world, that one of the Goyisha historians of that time mentions it. The historian Tacitus mentions it in his histories. Pogoichus, what about the Pogoichus? Was the exaggeration? It's not. We learn in a Mishnah in Shkolim, Reb Shimon on the Olim, Reb Shimon Esgan. Paroichas Uvia Tefa. The Paroichas was a Tefa thing. Now, which Paroichas are we talking about? Rashi says we can be talking about the one in front of the Ulam. So you have the main building of the Beis Mikdash, the front entryway, if it was called the Ulam. There was no door over there, but it was a large, it was a huge opening, 40 amas tall and 20 wide, and it was covered by a Paroichas, by a curtain. So Rashi says we may be referring to that curtain. Or the other possibility, Rashi says we may be referring to the curtain between the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKadosh. Anyway, Oivya Tefach, the thickness of it was a Tefach, Bal Shudim of Shnai Nirim Meregas. It was woven with 72 Nirim. Nirim are heteros. When you have a loom, you have the frames of the loom through which you pass the Shesim threads, and then you weave them, then you weave back and forth with the aid of threads. So you have a larger piece of fabric. You need a larger number of loops in the frame through which you thread the Shesim threads, and then raise them and lower them ultimately, fortunately, during the weaving. So Shem and Amiel is telling us that they had, that it was said that they used, that there was 72, each frame that they used for weaving the parochas had 72 of those heddles to pass the shesi threads through them. Another gear says, not nirin, but nimin, which means that there were the actual number of threads that made up the thickness of the parochas. Every one of those threads was actually a 24-ply thread, because the parochas were made of tchelas v'agamon, the selas shani v'sheish, and each one of them, the Gemara explains in Yuma, they had six threads of each one, which they twisted together to form a thicker thread, and then they twisted four of those together. So it was a 24-ply thread of six plies of each of these four different colors. The length was 40 amas and the width was 20 amas. Again, if it was the one in front of the ulam, then that was the dimensions of the doorway of the ulam. If it's the one in front of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, Rashi points out, well, also there the dimensions are the same thing. The hecha was 40 amas tall and 20 amas wide, so therefore the parochas in front of the Kodesh HaKadoshim would have had to be the same size. It was made out of 820,000, there are a few different explanations among them, for what that means. It means the whole cost of it was 820,000 gold dinar, or it can mean that it had contained altogether 820,000 threads. It said 72 threads thick, but then you have to think of the length and the width of it. And then there's another girsa, instead of riboy, rather revoice, there's a girsa that the word is revoice, which means young girls. They would have 82 young girls who are not yet old enough to become tamei with nidus, would be the ones to make the parochas, because that way they won't accidentally be metameid as they make. They would make two every year. So if it means the one in front of the ulam, then it means they would replace it every half year. If it means the ones in front of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, in the second Beis Mikdash, they in fact had two parochas in, an amma apart, and therefore it means that they would make two new ones every year. And if they needed to tovel it, if it became tomei, then 300 koyanim would have to tovel it. Now, this is also Lashon Havai. This is also an exaggerated thing. It never took that many koyanim to tovel it. You also have an interesting chat from the Vilna Gaon that makes a calculation. He says if you think of the perimeter of it, it was 40 by 20 amas. Convert the amas into tefachim, and then each tefach is the size of a person's hand. He says it comes out the perimeter of it was 300 tefachim. So therefore, in other words, the idea is, hypothetically, you could have, if you have 300 koyanim, each one holding one tefach of it, then there could fit that many koyanim. Again, it's hard to say the calculation should necessarily work, because the amma that was used for kalim in the Mishkan, according to some, in the Mishkan and the Beis Mikdash, according to some opinions, was a different size. But anyway, again, it's Lashon Havai, but again, there's a deeper meaning in it. So Rabbi Yitzchok Ben Nachmani is saying that particular detail. The rest of the details about the parochas are factual, but this one, that they needed 300 koyanim to tovel it, is an exaggeration. It never would need that many. This just gets into a bit of a question: when would parochas possibly become tamei in the first place? But Tosfos says that. If we're talking about the one in front of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, it was actually, the Gemara explains elsewhere, it didn't actually hang just straight up and down. A little bit of it was bent over to form, like, symbolically a covering over the Aron, and in that sense, it's considered like an oihel, and in that case, it can be Mekabel Tshuva. So there's our examples of Havai, of Lashon Havai, of Lashon Guzma in the Gemara. Again, if one said, not the one about giving the Talmud to drink from a golden cup, but just these other three about the Tapuach and the other two. Okay. Now, we had said in the Mishnah, Yerach Sheyimin of Yerach Shel Shmuel. We said that the issue of Yidanosha applies equally to the right thigh and the left thigh. So now, the Gemara says, Mas Nisim loy to Rabbi Yehuda. Our Mishnah is not like Rabbi Yehuda. It's Tanya Rabbi Yehuda. We learn a bright that Rabbi Yehuda says, Ein enoig ela ba'achas, the issue of Yidanosha applies to only one thigh. Va'das machlas as Sheyimin. A certain logic compels us to say that it must be the one of the right layer. So our Mishnah is obviously disagreeing with that. So now, what does Rabbi Yehuda mean when he says das? Iboilahu, nifshit pshitalei Rabbi Yehuda. Is it that Rabbi Yehuda says that even though we don't find it explicitly, we can deduce that it means the right leg, or my das Torah, and it means that we can deduce from a source in Torah itself, that it's the right leg. You have the famous expression das Torah, where a person is supposed to ask, we ask our rabbanim, not just about matters of actual halacha, but matters of public policy or whatever. That expression das Torah comes from this Gemara over here. So does Rabbi Yehuda mean das Torah, that from the Torah itself we can deduce that it means the right leg? Or maybe Rabbi Yehuda has a suffix about it. Or my das noite. What does he mean das? He means logic, human logic would dictate that it means the right, but I don't have a solid source for it in Torah. What would be the logic? Rashi explains. Well, where do we get the issue of Gid Anosha? It's from the story of Yaakov fighting with the Malach. Now, when two people are fighting and grappling with each other, each one is wrapping his arm around the other one and trying to knock him down. So here, the Malach then would have wrapped his right arm all the way around Yaakov's back, all the way to his right is opposite Yaakov's left, but he'd be wrapping his arm all the way around Yaakov to the other side and then hitting him, and then the end, his hand would hit him on his left thigh. To his right thigh, and therefore that would be the logic to say that the Yid Anosha should apply only to the right thigh. So what does he mean? So what does Rabbi Yehuda mean? What's his basis for saying that it means only the right? An actual proof in the Torah, or just logic like that of how people wrestle and grapple? So the Gemara says, Toshma, we can prove from the following. When it comes to the Korban Pesach, we know that you can't break any bones in it, and like any other Korban, when there's noiser, then you have to burn it. So a Mishnah says that some of Sagidim, the bones in the Gidim of the Korban Pesach, the Noser, and any leftover meat of it, he's so full. The Shish also have to be burnt on the 16th of Nisan. You can't burn them on the first day then that you eat the Korban Pesach, the night going into the 15th of Nisan. That's Hatzoi, so that Aloysa Shachar, according to different opinions, it becomes Noser, but you can't burn it then. The Gemara elsewhere learns from Sukkim that you can't burn it on Yom Tov. So you have to wait until the 16th, which in Eretz Yisrael is the first day of Chol HaMoed, and then you burn it. So now, in Masechta Pesachim, the Gemara asks, Ani Gidi Mayavintai, what kind of Gidim are we talking about? E Gide Boser, are we talking about Gidim that are soft enough to be considered part of the meat? So then what's the problem? Just eat them. What do you mean? Why should you be leaving them over and burning them? You should have eaten them. If you didn't eat them, then they're just part of regular noisir. The Idi'iyatr, so if you could have eaten them, then you should eat them. The Idi'iyatr, and if they were left over behind a noisir, then that's noisir, and there's no reason for the mission to mention separately. Ela Gide Tzavar. Evidently, we have to be talking about the Gidim of the neck, the very hard, tough ligaments in the neck. So now they're obviously inedible. So the Gemara asks, well, why should you have to burn them specifically? E lav boson inu, if they're not considered flesh, lishdinu, then you should just be able to throw them out. Like we said before about the Gid Anosha of the Shlomim, that you can just throw it out. So here, why should you have to save it until the first day of Halamayan and burn it? It's only the Mishnah is needed, only to tell us about the Gid Anosha, which could have been eaten, if were it not for the fact that the Torah says it's also, and then it would follow the opinion of the Yehuda. That Mishnah, he says that the concept of that the issue of Gid Anosha applies to only one leg. Now, we have a suffix, according to him, which one? So therefore, of necessity, you can't eat either one, because you don't know which one. So therefore, but nevertheless, one of them could have been eaten, and therefore the Mishnah can't just leave it in the regular category of Noser, it's in a category of its own. Now, if you say that Rabbi Yehuda has a suffix, and he doesn't have a solid source in Torah, he doesn't have das Torah to tell us that it applies to only the right leg shaper, then we understand. That's why. So now, even with das noita, no matter what human logic you can bring to bear, nevertheless, Rabbi Yehuda can't be sure that it doesn't mean the left leg. Therefore, you can't eat the Gid Anosha of either one of them. And therefore, of necessity, you have to leave it over and you have to burn it. Eli Amit Mifshep Chitale. But if you say that Rabbi Yehuda knows definitively, if he knows by Das Torah that the Gid Anosha only of the right leg is also, so what do you mean? Dehetero Lechle, the one that's Mutter from the left leg, he should eat Isur Lishia, and the one that's Isur Lishia, and the one that's also from the right leg, he should throw out, because not Roy Lachila, why would you need to save it and burn it with the Nose? So therefore, doesn't that show that he doesn't actually have a proof, he doesn't have a Das Torah, just a Das Nota to say that it's the right leg only? But the Gemara says not necessarily. Actually, you could say that Rabbi Yehuda does know definitively that with Das Torah that it's the right leg. But you know what you're talking about over here? To begin with, you had them distinct. You knew this one was from the right leg and we can't eat it, and this one is from the left leg and we could. But then you were safe and sorrowful, and then they got mixed up. So now you have no choice but to burn both of them. So the Gemara continues. We'll do a couple more lines. Rav Ashi Yomer, Lenitzuchai L'Shamnoi. Rav Ashi says, here's another point. The Mishnah is not really talking only about the Gid Anosha itself. The Gid Anosha itself, you're right, you could maybe throw out. And Rabbi Yehuda knows for sure that it's only the one from the right leg that's also. But the point of the Mishnah is the fact around the Gid Anosha. The Tanya, with an advice, a Shamnin Mutter, the fact around the Gid Anosha is Mutter. However, Jews who are holy and make a Siyog La-Torda, make a fence around the Torda, to not accidentally eat something that is Osir. So that's a Nogu Ba-Yisr. Jews are noyed to consider it Osir and they don't eat it. So now, I mean, our Torah, it could have been eaten, but because you can't eat it, therefore it's going to require to be burnt because midaraisa, you could have eaten it, and therefore you can't just say you should throw it out. So that would be easier. That would be another explanation of the Mishnah. So again, that doesn't require us to say that Rabbi Yehuda knows for that. That doesn't require us to say that Rabbi Yehuda has a suffix about that Rabbi Yehuda has a suffix about which one it applies to. The Gemara says Ravina Omar. Ravina gives a third answer. Lenitzuchai l'chidush Rabbi Yehuda. The chidush would be l'chidush Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel. The chidush would be that it would have to go according to what Rabbi Yehuda the Amora tells us in the name of Shmuel. The Amar of Yehuda Amar Shmuel shnei gidin hain. Rabbi Yehuda says in the name of Shmuel there are actually two different gidim that are relevant over here. You have an inner one, which is close to the bone, and that one is also when a person is chayav malchus for eating it. Chitzin, samach lebasar, but then there's an outer one that's closer to the flesh also. That one is also the in chayav and olive, however, a person is not chayav malchus for eating it. So now, in other words, the inner one being that's also midaraisa, then you don't have to save it. You could just burn it. But you don't even have to burn it. You could just throw it out. But the gidachitzin, given that midaraisa would be mutter, and it's only midarabanan that it's also, which is why a person is not chayav malchus for it, then therefore that one would have to be saved, because min haTorah would have been edible, and therefore you have to burn it with the rest of the Korban Pesach on the 16th. So what are the pnimi and the chitzin? There's quite a bit of discussion about that in terms of the actual anatomy over there and in terms of what Rashi says over here. The most common understanding is that the gida pnimi, which is close to the bone, would be the sciatic nerve, and then the gida chitzin would be a different nerve over there called the femoral nerve. But there's different possibilities about it based on the wording of Rashi over here is a little bit obscure, and you have different minhagim about it, about which nerves over there exactly are Osir and which are mutter. As far as this point, by the way, that we're saying that the Yisroel Kedoshim are knowing not to eat the fat around the Gid Anosha, and therefore it ends up having to be burnt. So a couple of things about the Minchas Chinuch points out that there's no Isur. Now you could ask, if you're leaving it over, then aren't you being over on the Isur not to leave over? Fine, the Torah tells us if you left over no Isur, you have to burn it. But are you not allowed to leave it over in the first place? So one answer is, in fact, Minchas Chinuch starts by saying that maybe it applies only to what's meant to be eaten, and the Gid Anosha, because of the Minag Not, so therefore the Isur of Nosir wouldn't apply to it. But he says that basically the Chachamim, we know, sometimes have the ability to tell us to be over passively on a mitzvah, and he says this would be an example of that kind of thing. And then actually you have the Chofetz Chaim actually seems to be saying that no, you should actually eat that fat. You actually should, again, to answer that part of it is to answer that question on the Rambam that we talked about before, how you're roasting the Korban Pesach intact, Gid Anosha, and fat and all. The answer would be that according to the Rambam, in fact, you do eat the fat around the Gid Anosha, and you override the usual minhag to do that. So the Rambam would be understanding the Gemara, the Gemara over here differently. So we'll continue tomorrow, Beis Hashem, and we'll talk more about this question of how Rabbi Yehuda says that it applies only to one, and he says that Hadas Machras Shayimin, what's his basis for saying that it means Zafka, the one of the right leg, and we're going to also learn tomorrow all about the Agadah, all about the actual story with Yaakov fighting with the Malach.